Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Greetings and welcome. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Just a taste of what you can look forward to in this broadcast. A musical comment on the first joyous mystery. What Lindisfarne, St. Cuthbert, and Eiderdowns could possibly have in common. And when a pope created a garden in a very Latin place. Well, thanks very much for joining me. As you know, October is the month of the Rosary. And so to mark the feast of Our Lady of the Rosary, which falls on the 7th of this month, I'd like to offer you a musical comment on the first of the joyous mysteries. To do this, I sought the help of a friend of our radio station, music historian Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
As we pray the Rosary, we're invited to meditate on the particular scene that the mystery evokes and to enter deeply into it as we recite the Our Father, the Hail Marys, and the Gloria Patri. Sometimes art can help us to focus our minds prayerfully on the mystery. Sometimes music can help. Those words, Ave Maria, Gratia Plena, take us straight to the heart of the first joyful mystery, the Annunciation. I'm sure we all have our favourite paintings of the angel appearing to Mary, maybe the one by Leonardo da Vinci, or that breathtaking fresco by Fra Angelico in the Convento di San Marco in Florence. But there are plenty of musical images too. For one thing, of course, there are lots of settings of the Ave Maria, bringing us the angel's greeting in song. Ave Maria, gratia plena. Then again, you'll often find composers telling the story of the Annunciation, as in this famous medieval English carol, Angelus ad Virginem subintrans in conclave.
Angelus ad Virginem subintrans in conclave.
The setting I've chosen to concentrate on today is different again. It's a modern piece by the living English composer John Taverner, a member of the Orthodox Church. He wrote this piece in 1992, and it's for two unaccompanied choirs. The larger choir represents the angel. And the smaller choir represents Mary, overawed and trembling, repeating at regular intervals the same phrase, "How shall this be, seeing I know not a man?" The piece works best if the two choirs are in different locations, so that you get the dramatic effect of the dialogue between Mary and the angel. The first time I heard it was in Westminster Cathedral in 1995, when John Taverner himself gave a lecture about sacred music, and it was illustrated by some of his own works sung by the cathedral choir. When they sang his Annunciation, the small choir representing Mary was in the Lady Chapel, while the large choir sang from the sanctuary. The effect was stunning.
Thank you.
music has a prayerful quality that's hard to describe, but you can tell it's the fruit of profound meditation on the part of the composer. It draws the listener into a deeper contemplation of the mystery too. I'd like to leave you with what, for me, is the most sublime passage of all, as we hear the angels sing, "Blessed art thou among women." Blessed indeed.
Warm thanks there, as always, to Monsignor Philip Whittemore, a music historian who is currently working at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. Meanwhile, moving on in the broadcast, it's time to join Jill Bevilacqua. Keeping her promise to us, Jill has prepared the second part of her personal pilgrimage to Lindisfarne, otherwise known as Holy Island, and indeed a place recognised as one of the most important sites in the history of Christianity in Britain. A place, as Jill explained last week, linked to the Venerable Bede, but also to the figure of another saint. He's Cuthbert, with whom Jill picks up the story.
In our last programme, we left Cuthbert on the island of Innisfarne, where he'd retired to live the hermit life.
For 9 years he lived there, in a turf oratory, sunken and walled, so that no vista of sea or land could draw his gaze away from heaven. At first, however, he walked his island, befriended the seals and birds who visited its shores. Many of the eider ducks allowed him to stroke them as they sat upon their eggs. Afterwards, local people named them St. Cuthbert's ducks.
Or, more familiarly, Cuddy's ducks. And it's a happy fact, noted one writer, that today Farne Island is a bird sanctuary. And indeed it is. You can visit it, as we did, by taking one of the many boat trips organised for the purpose, except for the breeding season, when the island is off-bounds. Actually, there are 28 Farne Islands, some of which emerge and submerge with the tides. Cuthbert's refuge was on Innisfarne, the largest of them. And as one guidebook points out, the Farne Islands were Britain's first nature reserve. St. Cuthbert passed an edict protecting the eider duck 1,300 years ago. Well, perhaps that he passed an edict is something of an exaggeration, but let's hear what a 12th-century Durham monk wrote on the subject.
Cuthbert, while he watched and prayed, assured the eiders a continuity of peace and quiet, allowing no one to touch them, slaughter them, or molest them with any mischievous intent. That ability to rear their young, which had been afforded them in time past, he assured them as a heritage forever, in glorious peace and watchful solitude.
Before the advent of the duvet, it was common practice in cool countries to put an eider down on top of the blankets on your bed. Young people, wondering what an eider down could be, will find this in the dictionary: a thick, warm quilt filled with eider down or other insulating material. For the eider duck lines her nest with the soft downy feathers from her breast, and these, you may read, are collected commercially as eider down. What, I wonder, would Cuthbert have thought of that? And curiously, the French name for the bird is eider à duvet. When you walk about on Innisfarne, you can get really close to the birds, for they're not afraid of people. We were there in August, and there were cormorants still feeding their young, while many other species of seabirds flocked about us: guillemots, kittiwakes, gulls, and of course, eiders. On our way over, we watched gannets diving for fish. Puffins flew by in a band. And on beaching at St Cuthbert's Cove, thousands of terns rose up to mob us. The other unique creature endemic to the farms is the grey or Atlantic seal. In fact, as you cross in the boat, scores of curious heads pop up from the sea to inspect the strange beings peering at them from the side of the boat. And these people of the sea, as the Irish call them, would have been Cuthbert's closest neighbours on his island hermitage. Of Cuthbert's extraordinary relationship with wildlife, we can read in Bede's Life of the Saint. And one episode in particular has caught the popular imagination. It took place while Cuthbert was still at Melrose Abbey, but was staying a few days at the Abbey of Coldingham, on a cliff above the sea. Recounts Bede.
As was his habit, at night when other men took their rest, he would go out to pray. And after long vigils kept far into the night, he would come home when the hour of common prayer drew near. One night, a brother of this same monastery saw him go silently out, and stealthily followed on his track to see where he was going or what he would do. And so he went out from the monastery, and his spy following him went down to the sea, above which the monastery was built. And wading into the depths, till the waves swelled up to his neck and arms, kept his vigil through the dark, with chanting voiced like the sea. As the twilight of dawn drew near, he waded back up the beach, and kneeling there, again began to pray. And as he prayed, straight from the depths of the sea came two four-footed beasts, which are called by the common people otters. These, prostrate before him on the sand, began to busy themselves warming his feet with pantings and trying to dry them with their fur. And when this good office was rendered, and they had his benediction, they slipped back again beneath their native waters. He himself returned home and sang the hymns of the office with the brethren at the appointed hour. But the brother who had stood watching him from the cliffs was seized with such panic that he could hardly make his way home, tottering on his feet, and early in the morning came to him and fell at his feet, begging forgiveness with his tears for his foolish attempt.
Cuthbert, of course, forgave him, but only on condition that he promised not to tell anyone what he had seen until after Cuthbert's death. The promise was given, the brother absolved, and he kept his counsel until after the saint's death, when, writes Bede, he took pains to tell it to many. In our own time, Gavin Maxwell, who kept otters, in his book Ring of Bright Water, offers his own version of what might actually have taken place that night.
I have but little doubt what the good brother of Coldingham Monastery really saw. St. Cuthbert had been praying at the water's edge, not, as the brother thought, it was, one must bear in mind, night, and the light was poor, up to his neck in the waves. It was entirely the condition of the saint's clothing, after he'd been dried by the otters, that led the observer to deduce some kind of submarine devotion. I know all about being dried by otters. I've been dried by them more times than I care to remember. Like everything else about otters, it takes place the wrong way round, so to speak. The otter emerges tempestuously from the sea, or the river, or the bath, as the case may be, carrying about half a gallon of water in its fur, and sets about drying you with a positively terrifying zeal and enthusiasm. Every inch of you requires, in the view of a conscientious otter, careful attention. The otter uses its back as the principal towel, and lies upon it while executing a series of vigorous eel-like wriggles. In a surprisingly short space of time, the otter is quite dry, except for the last 4 inches of its tail, and the human being is soaking wet, except for nothing. It's no use going to change one's clothes. In a few minutes, the otter will come rampaging out of the water again, intent upon its mission of drying people.
For Maxwell, it was not so much a blessing as an absolution, which, as he writes, the now shivering and bedraggled saint bestowed upon his tormentors. And he concludes,
"It is apparent to me that whatever other saintly virtues St. Cuthbert possessed, he had well merited canonization by reason of his forbearance alone."
Well, you can choose whichever version of the otter story you prefer, for there was only one witness, and he is not available for questioning. But let's return now to the island where Cuthbert lived out his final years, and where his spirit forever lingers. From the mainland, you take the boat from the little port of Sea Houses, a few miles to the south of Lindisfarne. It's quite a choppy crossing to the Farnes, for this is the North Sea. Storms rage frequently about the islands. Shortly before Cuthbert's death, one such tempest lasted 5 full days before his monks could risk crossing from Lindisfarne to minister to him. Cuthbert was not allowed to be a hermit in peace. 2 years before his death, he was elected bishop and had to return to Lindisfarne. But in 686, after celebrating Christmas with his monks, he withdrew once again to the island, and on March the 20th, 687, he died. One of the monks who'd come over to visit him went immediately up to higher ground and held up a lighted candle in each hand to signal to the monks on Lindisfarne of Cuthbert's passing. Though he would have wished to be buried on his island, Cuthbert allowed his monks to persuade him to will his remains to Lindisfarne, on condition that if they were ever compelled to forsake their home, they should carry his bones with them. And this, as we shall see, became necessary. Cuthbert was first buried in a stone tomb to the right of the altar in the Abbey Church. But so numerous were the pilgrims that flocked across to Lindisfarne that 11 years later the monks decided to move the coffin to a shrine above ground level so that the faithful could touch it. When the body was exhumed, however, it was found to be incorrupt. To the monks, this was a clear sign that Cuthbert was a saint. And it was this sign which produced what was to be the crowning glory of their island, the Lindisfarne Gospels. So the golden age of Lindisfarne did not end with the death of Cuthbert. In the century that followed, the monks produced what was to be one of the world's most celebrated illuminated books and one of Britain's greatest artistic masterpieces. The Lindisfarne Gospels are today in the British Museum. An inscription added in the 10th century states that the manuscript was made by Eadfrith, Bishop of Lindisfarne, who died in 721. And that the work was produced in honour of God, St. Cuthbert, and the whole company of saints whose relics are on the island. The story of the great saint of the North Country is told by Bede, who was 14 years old when Cuthbert died, and who certainly met and spoke with many who knew the saint. When he wrote his book, he submitted it to the Lindisfarne community for approval, almost certainly taking it to them in person. But in 793, disaster struck. Bede, writes one, had been dead for more than half a century when the dragon prows of the Viking longships appeared off the Northumbrian coast and the fury of the Northmen was visited on Lindisfarne. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicles record.
793. In this year, fierce, foreboding omens came over the land of Northumbria and wretchedly terrified the people. There were excessive whirlwinds, lightning storms, and fiery dragons were seen flying in the sky. These signs were followed by great famine, and shortly after, in the same year, on January 8th, the ravaging of heathen men destroyed God's church at Lindisfarne through brutal robbery and slaughter.
The surviving monks rebuilt their monastery, but the Viking raiders returned again and again to ravage and pillage. Finally, in 875, the monks fled, bearing with them the body of Cuthbert in its splendidly carved coffin of wood, the great Gospel Book of Lindisfarne, and other precious relics. For 200 years, Lindisfarne remained uninhabited, until the Benedictines came in 1082 and built a priory. To commemorate the holy blood shed during the Viking invasions, they renamed Lindisfarne Holy Island. And once again monastic life flourished there, until the dissolution of the monasteries under Henry VIII. And the body of Cuthbert? After various peregrinations, it finally found rest in 995 at Durham, where the monks, as one writes, built a little church of wands and branches to shelter the relics on the rocky plateau in a loop of the River Wear. Here the Normans built the massive cathedral, which in 2006, 900 years after its erection, was rededicated as the Cathedral Church of Christ, the Blessed Mary the Virgin, and St. Cuthbert of Durham, to mark the saint's stature as an icon of the region. You can go to Durham, as we did, and stand before Cuthbert's tomb in the Chapel of the Nine Altars. Go also to the Galilee Chapel at the other end of the great cathedral, where Bede is buried. But the spirit of Cuthbert lingers elsewhere, together with that of Aidan, on the island of Lindisfarne and on Inner Farne, where his beloved Idas and all those myriad other birds live in peace, while those grey creatures of the sea frolic around the island shores. In the little chapel on Inner Farne, a letter is posted up on the wall. It's from a present-day Norwegian bishop, apologising for the behaviour of his ancestors and asking pardon. As they say, it's never too late to mend. When you visit Holy Island today, you'll see ruins of the Benedictine Priory and the parish church. Nearby is a statue of St. Aidan. In one hand, he holds his bishop's crozier, in the other, a torch symbolising the light of the gospel. Standing among the ruins, you can look across at Lindisfarne Castle, built in the 16th century as a fortress against the Scots, and adapted as a private residence in the 19th century by the famous architect Lutyens, with a walled garden designed by the equally famous Gertrude Jekyll. But how do you actually get to Lindisfarne? Leaving the inland road, you turn right for the coast, and from the tiny resort of Beale, drive across the 3-mile causeway. Alternatively, you can walk across the sands, following St. Cuthbert's Way, the original route the monks would have taken. But although it's marked by poles, you're advised to take a guide with you. The island itself can only be visited on foot. Cars must be parked in the council car park on the edge of the village. Like most shrines today, Lindisfarne has its share of tourist trappings. But when you walk over the grass among the ruins of the priory and look out to sea, the centuries seem to fall away. You can sit on a bench by the great statue of St. Cuthbert and look across to the tiny islet nearby where he first sought refuge as a hermit. And over there, more distant, is Inner Farne, where he and Aidan before him communed alone with God.
Gratitude there to Jill Bevilacqua for taking us with her on this very personal pilgrimage to Lindisfarne. Many thanks also to Sean Patrick Lovett, whose voice you've just heard. And finally, time to join our popular Latin lover for our weekly rendezvous. He's Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, the Pope's own Latinist, and he speaks to us of a monumental garden once created by a Pope. Watch the change of pace and tone. I want to go back to the Palatine Hill with you today. It has around it a fringe of pines, cypresses, ilexes.
Yeah. As I say now, they've fixed it up so nicely with the parks.
But the idea of creating gardens there occurred to a pope, didn't it? Paul III Farnese, long after the Romans.
Oh, yeah, the Farnese gardens up there. He had ornamental gardens and almost like a bird refuge or something.
How'd you say bird refuge? Monumental gardens with a bird refuge.
Okay, cum volucrum perfugio. With refuge for birds.
Did they put them in cages?
No, they were just flying around. Yeah, Farnese, the Farnese Gardens.
The time of Emperor Charles V, known in the 1500s. Mm.
No, he's 34 to 49.
Paul III Farnese.
Yeah, 1534 to 49, 15 years.
Do you think the Romans shared this love of gardens with this Pope Paul Farnese?
I don't think so. They must have been quite secluded up there and,
you know, we talk about Italian gardens or French gardens laid out in a geometrical fashion, as opposed to English gardens that are left to roam or are less.
Yeah,
well, do you think the Romans would have had more Italian-type gardens or English-type gardens?
No, I think Italian. They have a topiarium. I mean, they had gardeners and ornamental gardens and
topiarium is the word we still use today.
Really?
When we say topiary?
I don't even know.
Topiary. When you shape hedges and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. They had that stuff.
How would you say nursery garden, where you grow little plants, where you...
Well, there you have seminarium.
Seminarium.
Seminarium, where the seedlings are put. Seminarium.
And did they have greenhouses, do you think?
No, they didn't have greenhouses. Apparently they didn't have greenhouses. They just went according to the seasons.
Did the Romans have green fingers, do you think?
What do you mean, green fingers?
Well, you know, people who are good with plants, they have
fingers. Certainly. They had their gardeners.
How would you say that in Latin?
Well, Hortulanus was a gardener, and Topiarius was a gardener, and...
How would you say a green-fingered Roman?
Cum digitis viridibus, but that doesn't mean anything.
The Romans were great explorers, no? They brought back plants from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
So... They did have an interest.
Some survived and some didn't, of course.
Yes, but they did have an interest in plants, though.
Oh, yeah.
If they brought them back with them.
Oh, yeah.
That's why in Rome we have oriental plants.
Oh, yeah. You can see in their paintings, they had all the varieties of things that you can imagine. The Roman frescoes and the birds and the scenes in their homes.
Not a lot has come down.
Not a lot, but we're discovering more all the time.
Mosaics have fared better.
Well, yeah, of course, they're durable, but...
How do you say mosaics fare better than frescoes?
Milius valent opera musiva con picture.
Did they actually grow vines and make wine on the Palatine Hill?
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, that was in the old days when you had a village up there and it was self-supporting village.
They grew artichokes.
Artichokes.
How do you say artichoke?
Cardooey.
Now, cardooey is a thistle.
Yeah, cards, yeah.
Now, how do you say artichoke?
Yeah, there's another word in there. I know I'm not...
Well, you can tell us some other day then what an artichoke is. Maybe the Romans didn't eat them.
Oh, they had them, for sure.
You know, it's interesting, but all religions promise believers a sort of lavish... horticultural reward in the next world. If you had to translate lavish horticultural reward.
Uberimum hortorum premium. That would be nice. A reward, a very rich reward of gardens. Oh, things in Latin are much better.
Heartfelt thanks there, as always, to our popular Latin lover. As you know, his name is Father Reginald Foster. He's a Carmelite who's currently working as the Pope's own Latinist at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. And that brings us up to time. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbury. Be sure to check out our website. The address is www.vaticanradio.org/English. Bye for now, and don't forget that we'll be back again at the same time tomorrow.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.